Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. With one of the longest-running best-selling adult hardcovers in publishing history, The Girl on the Train, Paula Hawkins became an international publishing phenomenon. The Girl on the Train spent over 100 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list, with over 40 weeks at number one, and has been adapted into a blockbuster movie starring Emily Blunt. Paula Hawkins now unfurls a gripping, twisting story of deceit, murder, and revenge in her latest novel, A Slow Fire Burning. When a young man is found gruesomely murdered in a London houseboat, it triggers questions about three women who knew him. Laura is the troubled one-night stand last seen in the victim's home. Carla is his grief-stricken aunt, already mourning the recent death of yet another family member. And Miriam is the nosy neighbor, clearly keeping secrets from the police. Paula Hawkins worked as a journalist for 15 years before turning her hand to fiction. Again, her new novel is A Slow Fire Burning. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Paula Hawkins to this week's book show. Paula, thank you very much for being with us. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Give us a sense of what brought you to this particular story, which I find interesting for many reasons, not the least of which is that you tend to, throughout the novel, question mystery novels themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things going on in this book. The original sort of the start of the story, I guess, for me came with a character. That's generally how I start my books. I'm thinking about a particular person. In this case, it was this young woman called Laura who's had a difficult life. She had an accident as a child, which has left her with some issues, some disabilities. One of the problems she has is something called disinhibition, which means that she kind of has no filter. She loses her temper quickly. She sometimes says things she oughtn't to say. She behaves inappropriately, in inverted commas. She's impetuous. And it means that her life is difficult. It means that others are quick to judge her without really understanding her. So I was thinking about a character like her. I didn't really know what her story was going to be, but I was spending a lot of time walking near where I live in London on the Regent's Canal, which is this canal that runs right the way through the heart of London. And there are houseboats in little sections along it. People live down there. And I was quite intrigued by that sort of that community, by the kinds of people who might choose to live down there. You know, most of the houses are very beautiful and little houseboats. I mean, very beautiful, very nicely kept. But every now and again, you'll see one that's kind of half sinking into the water. It's obviously not been touched for a very long time. And it did sort of start me thinking that there could be anything inside one of those, any, you know, human remains, a body, whatever. And so it was these two things that I brought together, Laura and the houseboats. And then I went from there.
And that's what brings Miriam, who lives next door to this houseboat, to look over and say, well, this has been there longer than it should. It doesn't look like it should. Let me go and check things out.
Yeah. And she discovers a body.
The body is of a young man. And then the story unfolds. I want to go back to something that you just mentioned as you start with the character. So do you start with the one character or do you start with really the trio in this case and then work your way out?
Well, it was Laura first and then Laura. And then I put her in a situation, a difficult situation where she's been at a crime scene. She's got blood on her. She stands accused. And then I start thinking about who else is involved in this story. And there was the neighbor, Miriam. There was Daniel's family. So that Daniel is the young man who's been killed. So I built a cast of characters around that. But I generally start with one character and sort of wonder what's the best story? How can I tell a story with this person?
What's interesting is that you don't immediately know if there is going to be a hero, right? I mean, it always, all of these people are deeply flawed and have their issues.
I guess I don't really deal in heroes, heroines in my novels. The characters in my novels are very rarely happy, well-adjusted people. They tend to be people who are having a pretty bad time in their life at the time that we meet them, or people who are trying to recover from some trauma or tragedy, people who are struggling, people who maybe aren't, who don't quite fit in society, who fail to meet society's expectations in some way. I'm interested in outsiders and what it's like to sort of struggle a bit. And so, yes, all these characters are going through difficult things, and particularly at the time at which we meet them, which is when a crime has been committed and backs her to the wall and there's blood on the carpet and everyone's frightened or angry or vengeful. So, there aren't obvious heroes, as you say.
And that certainly seems to be more of a mirror on us than anything else, right? I mean, there aren't many of us who are happy and well-adjusted.
Well, I mean, I hope that generally in society, people are slightly better adjusted than they are in my novels. But this is a crime novel. You're not coming to it for people who are living out their happy, blameless existences. This is generally people in problematic circumstances. But I do also believe that most of us in difficult situations can get ourselves into trouble, can go to extremes, can behave in all sorts of terrible ways. That doesn't necessarily make you a bad person. It makes you a person having a really bad time.
As you explore these characters, we realize just how much pain they are going through. A lot of them are shouldering a lot of guilt. And then, oh, by the way, there's vengeance that comes in for not just one of these characters, but for many of them. And so that becomes interesting to see how that all folds against each other when these characters are pitted against each other at various times in the novel.
Yeah, they have all suffered some kind of trauma or tragedy or loss or, you know, of varying degrees. And these are all problems of their past, but they're sort of what I was sort of exploring is how the things that you hold inside eat away at you eventually, and how they need to be dealt with. And so everybody is dealing with their own thing. And yes, when they come into conflict with other people, they may act in extreme ways. They may lash out at completely the wrong person. But that's a sort of a consequence of the problems that they themselves are dealing with.
As I mentioned early on, you do really look at your craft in this book, and you talk about writing, and you talk about mystery novels, and you talk about fiction. And I do not recall that being the case in your previous novels. Is this the first time you've really sort of looked at it in a way with a bit of a wink and a nod?
Yeah, I think obviously the last 6 years of my life since The Girl on the Train was published have been very much consumed by the writing and reading of novels, or the writing being published, being edited, being reviewed, being criticized. All of those things have been, you know, at the forefront of my mind. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I did want to write about, I wanted to include some of that, some of the things that I've been thinking about in the book, about what it is to write crime, to read it, why are we so interested in it? Is there a right way to do it? And I guess the conclusion I came to is there's no one right way to do it. There's so many great, you know, the genre encompasses so much mystery and crime. But yeah, I was having a bit of fun with it too. There's a novel within the novel in this book. There's a best-selling novelist, and it allowed me to maybe to lighten some, because there are many dark subjects in this book, but it allowed me to do some lighter things as well.
You're writing about Theo in this case, who has written a successful novel, The One Who Got Away, which is the novel within the novel that we read in here. And you say, you write, "Someone let the cat out of the bag," which meant, of course, that the book became an instant bestseller, but it also had the critics sharpening their knives. Some of the reviews were quite vicious, and it brought all the crazies out of the woodwork. You saw my story. It achieved its central aim, however. It got Theo writing again. That was the thing. When the muse fell silent, Theo refused to give up. He seized upon a scrap of a story and he made it his own. That was the truth of it. For you, did it feel that way too, that it was when you started writing these books that it got you writing, and it got you writing something that you enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, I had written novels before I wrote The Girl on the Train, but I'd written them under a pseudonym and they never really felt like me. They were romantic comedy, which was completely the wrong genre for me. And in hindsight, when I settled on the character of Rachel, I knew that she was Rachel from The Girl on the Train. That I knew that she was the right character for me to be writing about. I immediately felt right when I started writing in Rachel's voice. I'm coming from a very different point of view than Theo, who was a literary novelist who just wrote a crime novel to get over his writer's block. That wasn't my situation. But I found crime as the perfect genre for me. It suits me. It suits my sensibility. It suits the way I write. I like the darkness of it. I like the kind of things that you talk about in it. So, it was right for me entirely.
You even asked the question about the idea of one of the characters says, well, why can't you just write in a linear fashion? Why do you have to go all over the place and have these different points of view? Which, of course, is what you employ. That's your style.
I was slightly having a joke at my own expense there and slightly becoming, I think, exasperated with myself because I do struggle to tell a story in a completely linear fashion, beginning to end from one point of view. I don't know why, but it's just not the way I tend to write. And so I do this thing where I, you know, timelines, you shift through timelines and there are different perspectives. And that is something that I enjoy doing. But I do also accept that some people find it exasperating and why can't you just be straightforward about things? But then, you know, that's the way I write. So I was, yes, slightly, anticipating the criticisms that would be leveled at me.
Not to insinuate any criticism at all in this, but it seems to me that by having that mix and not writing in a linear fashion, that it allows you, and not to say that there's any part of this that is easy, but that it could be then easier to do these amazing plot twists that you pull off.
Certainly, yes, that's how I find it. That's the way I've there are sleights of hand in that. You can hide things if you write that like that, or that's the way I do. So you see something from one point of view, but you only see it partially, which is how we all perceive everything, because we only perceive it from our own points of view. But yes, so if you alter perspective every now and again, you can reveal a new side to something that you didn't the first time around. Or by going back in time, you can cast something in a new light. If somebody's thinking back on something or remembering something, you can cast it. They can see it a different way. So yes, certainly that is part of how I construct a crime novel, where you do have to hide something in order for it to be surprising and suspenseful. Sometimes you do have to hide things from the reader.
These are women who are ultimately trying to right the wrongs that have been done to them.
Yes, or that they perceive have been done to them. Yes, I think I was interested in looking at female anger, and particularly the anger of middle-aged women, maybe, because that's frequently seen as ridiculous, middle-aged women being angry about things. They are, middle-aged women in general, I think, are often seen as ridiculous. And I was interested in having a look at some of them who aren't ridiculous at all and whose anger is valid and whose rage at the world is completely true, and who have very good reason to be angry, but who also feel invisible or powerless, and who are wanting to take back some power in their lives.
What do you think that becomes part of their lives, that invisibility?
What, middle-aged? At a certain point, this is our culture, isn't it? That at a certain point, women are no longer interesting if they're not beautiful and fertile and... well, in fact, those things, beautiful and fertile, they're not really that important anymore. I mean, that is a view. That's not my view, clearly. But I think that's a lot of people, that culture up to this point has often dismissed women past a certain age.
You mentioned fertile, but the one character of you couldn't possibly understand love if you've never had a child.
I think that is a view that a lot of people take. Not only women, a lot of parents yes. would argue, and I can't argue against them because I've never been a parent, but they would say that, I mean, I think that is something that is often said, you don't understand. I can't disprove that. I know from the point of view of a childless person that you sometimes feel a little bit affronted by that, but it may well be right. There are all sorts of different kinds of love. And obviously parental love is a particular thing and is particularly fierce. And I'm intrigued by it. Having never experienced it, I'm still intrigued by it.
Yes, I've never experienced it either. But it seems that in this book, you really look at it from the point of view of the parents, of how they, in the death of a child, let's say, that is all consuming in their lives forever. As I guess it's obviously perfectly understandable to be that way.
I think there are some tragedies that people don't recover from, and that may be one of them, that sort of loss. There are some things that people, or some people, will never get over. And that's an awful thing to consider. But I do think that that's the truth of it.
You say the word consider, but you do explore impact a lot. You explore the impact of tragedy in our lives. Mm.
Yes, that is something that has always intrigued me. I think I don't know why I'm like this, but whenever I read a story in the newspaper or hear a story that somebody's told me of something shocking or traumatic happening, I always wonder what it does to you later. How, after the sort of the dust has settled initially, how long down the line do you feel the effects? How far out do the ripples spread from that stone hitting the water? You know, at what point do you stop feeling something? Does it change you forever? Does it change the way you are? In this book, we have someone, for example, Laura, who has a physical impact years and years later, but there's also obviously psychological impact, and those can be far worse. I am just sort of intrigued by those things, and also by the fact that everyone you meet later in life will not have any, that they don't know about your past trauma. They don't understand why you are the way you are. And I guess it's just maybe even a note to myself to be more understanding of people who perhaps respond to things in ways that you don't get at all, because you just don't know what's underlying, or, you know, the way people respond to things.
Paula Hawkins is our guest in this week's book show. The new novel is A Slow Fire Burning. You mentioned the ripples a moment ago. Do you always know how far the ripples are going to go as you begin?
No, I don't. I'm not somebody who plots out every part of a novel before I write it. I need to know, right, there's a central mystery here. It's the murder of Daniel, and I know who did it, and I know why. But there is an enormous amount that gets filled in as I write, because to me, to plot the entire novel in great detail, I think it would probably make the writing easier, but it would also make it a lot less fun, would make it rather mechanical. I think you come up with your best ideas when you're in the thick of the story. Not all those connections sort of come to you while you're steeped in those situations and the locations and the characters. So for me, I think my way of doing it is definitely slower. I meander, but I think it's richer. It's a richer experience for me, and hopefully for the reader too.
Absolutely. You just use the word fun. You use the word fun quite a bit in the novel, sometimes in a macabre way, sometimes in a manic way. But you use that word fun.
Oh, do I? I hadn't noticed that I did that.
Mostly with Laura. In that, oh, this could be fun. And
oh, the, right.
That you look at it as something, and that sort of gives you an idea about Laura, but also of this idea of sort of the rush of life and dealing with all of the issues that you have to deal with can sometimes be a fun rush.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she's a playful person, Laura. For all her problems, she does have a great sense of, she's, you know, a good sense of humor, and she's vibrant and lively, and she does have a sense of fun. So she's young, you know, she still has that. But I guess actually I do think that, well, one of the things I liked about writing Irene, who's the eldest character in the book, she's 80, she also retains a kind of sense of adventure, which is one of the things that I admired about that character. And I think it's important to try and hold on to that sense of adventure, even if when things are tricky.
When you think about the motivation and the psychological motivation for crime, you look at it from many different angles, don't you? It's not just one way that you look at it.
Well, I suppose I am looking at the types of crimes that I'm writing about, or the types of situations. They don't tend to be, I'm not talking about bad people necessarily. I'm not talking about people who live a life of crime, who are involved in some sort of criminal enterprise, or who are sociopathic or what have you. What I tend to be writing about is people who could have been fairly ordinary, but whose lives have become derailed by something. And so there are all sorts of different motivations that people might get in by, might do something wrong. And I do keep returning to the fact that I think that it could happen to any one of us had we also been knocked off course in the way that one of these characters has been. So yes, I think I do look at it in the round and from all sorts of angles, and I don't condemn the characters for some of the bad things they do I condemn them for, but not all of them.
As I said, you read about crime fiction itself, and I assume that you were greatly influenced by crime writers. Give us a sense of that, of those influences, and and how they stick with you?
Well, I guess like many people, if I go back sort of chronologically, my first dabblings with crime mystery novels were with Agatha Christie, mm-hmm. who I read when I was sort of 12, 13. And in those days, I was thrilled by the puzzle. It wasn't the characterization or anything like that. It was the figuring it out. Can you figure out who done it? I remember reading And Then There Were None and just being absolutely blown away by this incredibly complex thing where you know all these people are being picked off one by one and you're trying to figure out who the killer is. I then didn't read crime for years, and then I guess in my 20s read The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is such a different kind of, you know, a really character-driven literary mystery, and I was absolutely blown away by that. I love the books of writers like Barbara Vine, Tana French. They tend to be very much character-driven mystery and crime novels. Mm. People like Megan Abbott, Laura Lippman, who write these very much character and the psychology of crime rather than the criminal act itself, and also rather than the actual procedure of figuring everything out.
And I think you mentioned Ruth Rendell and P.D. James in your novel.
Yes, absolutely.
Well.
They're mentioned in there, and also I enjoy the sort of tipping over into horror, the kind of Shirley Jackson, that sort of kind of almost ghost story, that gothic horror. I'm a big fan of that kind of stuff, although it does scare me.
All women, I will note that you just mentioned.
They are all women, isn't there? And I'm sure there are. Cormac McCarthy, who I know people will say he's not a crime writer. What he writes is a... But,
yeah.
You know, I absolutely
Brilliant.
Adore that his... Yeah, he can conjure up whole worlds in a few words. He's wonderful. So I do read men as well. I sound like I'm very. I am. It's true that I do read definitely more women than men. But there are also a lot of men that are doing this kind of stuff brilliantly too.
When you look at your career, and you mentioned, and we talked about touch on this a moment ago, of kind of looking at the craft after the success of The Girl on the Train. Obviously, you can't be ready for anything like that. How does that impact you? Does it change you? What does it do to you as a writer? Does it impact what you do in the future?
Well, I mean, it's a really difficult question because obviously there are so many different impacts I think it has. Because on the one hand, you can say, well, having a huge success means writing the next thing is quite daunting because you know so many people are going to be paying attention to what you do and so many eyes are going to be turned upon it, which is obviously a good thing, but it is also it makes you hesitate. It makes you second guess yourself. Am I doing this right? If I get anything wrong, people will notice, you know, people will talk about it. So there's that. However, at the same time, obviously having a huge success is also very freeing because it means that I don't need to write a book every year. I don't need to thrill my, you know, obviously you want to make your publishers happy, but you've already kind of made them pretty happy. So you're maybe under slightly different pressures, but yeah, so there is a way in which it's liberating. But at the same time, there's also that sort of daunting quality. And frankly, when I'm actually writing, I try not to think about any of it at all. But that is, you know, that's an effort to put it all out of your mind. But I do think there's a point at which you just have to think, well, this is my character. These are the people I want to talk about. This is the novel I'm writing now. And try and shut out the world and just pour yourself into that story. Because otherwise, I don't see how anybody gets anything done.
You slipped in that idea of not having to write a novel a year. And I would think that would be freeing, that you have time then to work on the next book.
Whereas a lot of writers are under pressure to deliver to a deadline, I can relax a little bit because, frankly, I'm financially comfortable now. So, I do want to keep writing. I do want to keep producing, but I'm not on that sort of novel a year treadmill that some writers find themselves on.
And there is a sort of, I would assume, the outside pressures of the publisher who wish that you would put out three books a year. But you then say, okay, look, this is what I want to do. This is what I can do. And this is how I will deliver.
Yeah, I have and I'm not being sort of, I am being completely honest. I have very good relationships with my publishers, both in the UK and in the US. And they are they have been incredibly supportive of what I've wanted to do. At no point have they said, oh, can't you just do The Girl on the Train too, please? I'm sure they might like for me to do The Girl on the Train too, but they have never asked for it. I've never felt under pressure to do something like more commercial or what have you than the last couple of books, which, you know, have been very different. So I've always felt completely supported.
Since this is a show where I talk to writers about their writing, I've found that basically you have two different types. One are people who already have the next book underway as they're talking about the book that's just coming out. And then there are the people who are saying, okay, I'm getting this one out, I'll do all the promotion, and then I'll worry about the next one. Where do you fall on that?
I mean, in the past, I did, when The Girl on the Train was published, I'd already started Into the Water, but this time I'm a little bit behind. I have ideas. I have characters in my head. As I say, there's usually a few characters marching around up there, and but I haven't put pen to paper yet. I will hopefully very soon. But yeah, I think this time I'm waiting until the publicity is over. I would rather have started earlier. I think that this year it's just been, everything's been quite strange, and I seem to have been a bit slower to get going.
Does it have an effect? Does a global pandemic have an effect just of dealing with life as opposed to sitting down and that solitary pursuit of writing?
I mean, when the pandemic obviously started in March last year, I was in the middle of the novel, and it was a good place to be, I think, that I knew exactly what I was doing. I just had to do it. I didn't have to come up with something new. I think trying to be creative, come up with new ideas and new characters and what have you in the pandemic would have been much harder. And no, I can't blame the pandemic for why I'm being a bit slow this time. It's just, I think it has been a difficult time for a lot of people creatively, but actually it wasn't bad for me in terms of actually just sitting down and getting the writing done, because you had that thing where you were stuck at home and you couldn't travel or see anyone anyway.
Paula Hawkins' new novel is A Slow Fire Burning. It is published by Riverhead Books. Paul, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new novel is A Slow Fire Burning. It is published by Riverhead Books. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.